It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2023, returning MOI Global instructors Ken Majmudar and Sam Namiri. Ken founded Ridgewood Investments in 2002 and serves as its chief investment officer, focusing on managing long-term value investing-based strategies. Prior to Ridgewood, Ken worked for 7 years on Wall Street as an investment banker at Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers, where he has extensive experience working on IPOs, M&A transactions, and other corporate finance advisory work for Fortune 1000 companies. Ken graduated with honors from the Harvard Law School in 1994 after being an honors graduate of Columbia University in 1991. With a bachelor's degree in computer science. He is a CFA charter holder. Sam is a portfolio manager and analyst at Ridgewood, where he concentrates on managing the Ridgewood Select Value Fund, a fund focused on investing in small and microcap companies. Prior to Ridgewood, Sam was an associate at Grand Slam Asset Management, a small cap hedge fund, and also the founder and president of Shop Network, a jewelry company. Sam has a BS in industrial engineering and operations research from the University of California, Berkeley, and an MBA from Columbia Business School. Great to have you back with us, Sam and Ken. I look forward to your presentation and would now like to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having us back. It's always a pleasure to have an opportunity to interact with you and the MOI community. We've loved being members, and we look forward to sharing this idea and hearing from other folks in Best Ideas about their ideas. So looking forward to sharing this idea. and there's just some disclosure here that we wanted to share because we're gonna share things that are somewhat forward-looking. You've already shared our backgrounds, so it's not a lot of time that we're going to spend here. Before we jump into our idea, I wanted to just quickly, for the benefit of the MOI community, remind folks about our work that we do. And most of the ideas that we've shared have been ideas that we've owned in our Select Value Fund, which is focused on mostly on small and microcap companies. And similar to other sort of long biased, value oriented, bottoms up investors, we in this fund, we look for concentrated positions with long holding periods. And we really take a private equity approach to investing in public companies. So that means really trying to understand the businesses, understanding the people running the business on our behalf. And definitely thinking the way an owner would, no matter whether our interest is fractions of a percent or a little bit bigger. And then we really are believers in company visits, due diligence, scuttlebutt, trade shows, and we do like to meet management teams. And one of the main things we look for is companies with, we would say, very good capital allocation skill as demonstrated by the management team's past capital allocation decisions. And it's pretty hard to find in general, and it's definitely quite challenging to find in smaller and microcap companies. But with the type of long time horizon that we try to own things as an owner mentality, probably almost more than any other factors, the quality of management and particularly their ability to allocate capital well, and the compounding that comes from reinvestment through good capital allocation of internally generated profitability is key to our approach. And also for those that are looking at this and may want to be on our distribution list, just send an email to sam@ridgewoodinvestments.com. We'll be happy to share with you our ongoing quarterly letters that we share with our partners. So we've presented now, I guess, four prior times. So this would be our fifth presentation. And obviously, it's a challenging market as of right now. And obviously, the first presentation was 2018. So we're going back, you know, I guess at this point, 5 years. So we had different price targets. Mostly we go for like a 2 to 3 year price target for the purposes of these presentations. And we didn't, you know, hold all of these throughout the whole period. But we just wanted to give folks a reminder of our past presentations that probably are still available on the MOI. I think they were all probably best ideas. So we presented Farmer Brothers, which we owned, and then it actually didn't perform well. And we actually ended up selling it because of new information that came out. But the price is now quite a bit lower, and there's a new management team in place there. And that, just to remind people, is a distributor of mostly coffee and other beverage type drinks to many, many retail and commercial type accounts. So we actually own Farmer again. So that just may be of interest. Our next presentation was Axos Bank, which used to be called Bank of Internet. And that's been roughly flat given where things are today. A third one is CRAI, which is a consulting type business. And that one, we actually exceeded our price target in roughly a 2 year period. So that one was a good success. And then the last one is Acme, which is somewhat below our price target. And I actually don't think we own it because of one concern that we had. That's just a quick review of what we have presented in the past. We own Farmer Brothers, we own Bank of Internet, and I think we own CRAI as well.
Just to step in, we do own Acme as well too.
We do. Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
So those are the four that we've presented, and today we're presenting a bank, which is a different bank. Obviously, previously we presented Axos, and the company today is a little bit of an unusual, I would almost call it like a special situation financial company, which has had a long and interesting history. As a smaller company, it's about a $400 million company. The price is around just above $18 a share. And it's called New Tech Business Services Corporation, listed on the NASDAQ. The ticker is NEWT. And for the reasons that we'll explain, we think there's good upside in this company. It's definitely quite a sort of complex situation. So probably for a lot of investors, just getting their arms around what it is and all the different things it does is part of probably the challenge here. But it's also quite unusual in the sense it's not, historically it was a non-bank financial company and actually was originally, or most recently, it was structured as a BDC, but it even has a history prior to becoming a BDC. And the big catalyst now, it's literally sort of new news in the sense that, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, they announced this plan to become a bank, maybe even a couple of years ago now, to become a bank holding company. And by the way, there's a typo here. It should say, obviously, January 2023 is the price. The big thing here is that they went from being a BDC, business development company, to a bank holding company. And that obviously has all kinds of implications on their business. Now, they did this very deliberately because they think that it's going to create a lot of advantages for their business model and create value for shareholders. So historically, they were a non-bank financial company, mostly providing sort of business and financing to small businesses. And the biggest line of business that they were in was providing SBA loans. So I think MOI, you know, we have members who are all over the world. So for those who may not know, in the US, SBA stands for Small Business Administration. And the idea is that the federal government created the Small Business Administration to encourage the growth of smaller companies where access to capital is much less easy to find, much less developed. And so what they did was they created these programs, the 7A and the 504, with a bunch of different nuances. But the basic idea of it is that there's banks and non-bank financial companies who are admitted to make these loans. And so they take applications from small businesses who would otherwise potentially be starved for capital. And if you meet the terms of these programs, then the lender gets, the government guarantees the loan against default by the business up to a certain percentage. So we're going to talk about some of those details here. And so what Newtek did was, in its most recent iteration, prior to becoming a bank holding company and a bank essentially through acquisition / merger, the company was mainly in the business of originating these SBA loans and funding those loans and then selling off the guaranteed portion and keeping the other portion on their balance sheet. And so I think relatively intelligently, they realized, well, hey, you know, these small business customers, they need all these other things, you know, payment processing, point of sale, IT, payroll, benefits. And so they have also, in their BDC format, created that ability through different offerings and subsidiaries to offer these other services that their clients who are also borrowing capital from them might need. And over time, you know, they've created good value under this management team. And so we do expect the growth to continue. But now with this catalyst, which I think the company literally just announced that just days ago, that the bank, the conversion to a bank finally went through. So, and it's a very long and torturous process. I mean, we first spoke to the management about their, you know, their intention to do this quite a while ago, over a year ago. And so every time we would meet with them, you know, they're just going through different steps of the process because you have to get approval from the regulators to become a bank, which is quite difficult to do. And there's a lot involved in that. So that finally happened. And in the process of going from a BDC, which pays a lot, very high dividends, to a bank, the stock price declined quite a bit. And, you know, there's a probably turnover of their shareholders. And so that both the catalyst of becoming a bank, but then also the turnover of their natural ownership base and the financial sort of nature of the company itself is changing in a lot of ways. And so we think that that is why there's an opportunity. So just a little bit of the history here. The company was actually founded in 1998. So it's basically 24 years old, became public and began trading on the American Stock Exchange in 2000 and NASDAQ in 2004. And this is probably like maybe you could kind of say the third iteration of the company, even though it's basically continuously running and operated by some of the same people. So in its first iteration, it's sort of an incubator investing in businesses and became the second largest SBA lender in the US, which it still is. And then as part of that, it became more efficient to convert to a BDC. So BDC stands for Business Development Corporation. And it's a structure where you would have two benefits. One is that the SBA gives you direct leverage if you choose to use it in your BDC format at low cost to incentivize lending to small businesses. but it's also a pass-through entity. So there's no entity level taxation. So similar to folks might be familiar with, like, for example, MLPs or partnerships. So the BDC format is similar to that, where you don't pay entity level tax as an incentive. But if you look at it from the history of the company, starting in 2015 when it became a BDC. So just literally in the last 7 years, it's paid $19.52 out in the form of dividends, and the stock is worth $18.36. And if you look at the price back then, it was roughly a little bit lower than where it is now. So essentially it paid out all of its stock price in the form of dividends. It's sort of a high dividend model. And now it's converting to a bank. So that's going to change the way the balance sheet is and a number of different aspects of the way the model is. But this is the chart of the stock price of the company. And you see at one point it was in the high 30s. That was all the way back in 04. And then it fell all the way to a little over a dollar a share in 2009. That would be the bottom of the financial crisis. And obviously a lot of financial companies, their stock prices certainly would have suffered since then. And so from that point up until its high, which was, if you look at it, dropped during the pandemic and then immediately it really spiked. And it's probably worth talking about that, though we touch on it later in the presentation. That so as an SBA lender, they were really well positioned to help folks with the PPP loans that became a big thing. And so that initial decline was, hey, you know, what's going to happen to their borrowing base? And then suddenly the PPP program came out and it became boom times. So it really went, the price went from, you know, roughly high teens at the bottom of the pandemic to, you know, into the 30s. And then it's come way down because as that PPP business, so to speak, was sort of a roughly a 2 year window of opportunity that they really capitalized on. And it was during that time, and probably in part because of that capital that they got through that, the profitability that they generated, they announced this idea that, hey, we're going to become a bank and we want to do that for a number of these reasons that they went into that we're going to explain here. So as I was mentioning during 2021, the company really made all time record profits, mostly from that generating the fee income from originating those PPP loans. And at the same time, that PPP business, which was a boom for them, also hurt their traditional SBA lending business, where they're the number two player. And so it was in late 2021. So here we are at the beginning of 2023. So it's basically a little over a year. They announced that they were acquiring the National Bank of New York City, which is not, it sounds like a great, you know, it sounds like a big bank, but it's a small bank that's been around for a long time. And so they found it, and they basically just finalized literally like this week, the process of converting to a bank holding company from a BDC. And so some of the big differences that causes in terms of the structure. Now they've obviously, when they announced this, so this was over a year ago, they said, hey, we're going to buy this bank and we're going to convert to a bank holding company. Obviously, in order to do that, we need to go through this long and tortuous regulatory process, which we're prepared to do, and it's going to take time. And they explain, like, you know, here's the reasons why we're going to do this and why we think it makes sense for shareholders. And so what, as I kind of mentioned, BDC is basically a pass-through. So by law, they're required to pay out basically most of their profits as a dividend. And part of the benefit of that is you don't get taxed at the corporate level. So without that tax, there's more to pay out. In contrast with the bank, they will be taxed, though the dividends will be qualified dividends. So they get taxed at the lower rate that qualified dividends do in the United States. But then, so why would they do this? Why would they elect for a structure that has them actually paying taxes when currently they don't? And the answer is that the bank structure gives them several large advantages. One of the main ones is a lower cost of capital, because essentially you can get deposits in a bank. And so lower cost, even compared to their funding, you know, their loan rates in the segment that they play in, their cost of funding was more of a non-financial institution. And as a bank, you get access to much more leverage and a much lower cost of capital. So given that the asset side of their balance sheet is already pretty significant, and they were making money even with a higher cost of funding by driving the cost of funding down and maybe potentially using more leverage that's available to a bank than would be available to a non-bank financial company, this structure will you know, let them essentially drive up their leverage and their spread. And so overall, that should actually increase their profitability. Now, with most BDCs, because they pay out all their profits and because it's more of an income-oriented play, the typical BDC is kind of in the generally the low double digit, you know, 10% into the mid-teens, versus banks are in the 2 to 4%. And just to give you, like, as an instance, as a for example, right now the stock price is around the just over $18 a share. In 2022, they paid $2.75 a share in dividends. So that would be well into the teens on a backward looking dividend yield. So let me hand it over to Sam to jump in and take us through a lot of the rest of the presentation.
All right. Thanks, Ken. Nice job. So I just wanted, Ken touched a lot of the points of the presentation, but I'm going to try to touch on some points that he didn't make and go a little more into detail. So he mentioned the SBA 7A loans, which has historically been a majority of their business. And the key point here is that 75% of the loan is guaranteed by the SBA. The guaranteed portion, they sell off. It's historically been around 10.5% premium. They sell it off. And there's quite a liquid market. They sell off pretty much every loan 1 to 2 weeks after they're made, the guaranteed portion. It had run up to some degree a little bit in 2021. But now it's actually below this 10% mark. So that's been kind of a headwind in the past year. And just to understand the loans, a lot of people are worried about rising interest rates. Again, historically, these loans are floating rate loans, and they adjust every quarter to the new prime rate. So now prime is at 7.5%. So their old loans are, you know, close to, like, above 10%. Most of them are 2 3/4% prime plus 2 3/4%. So now they're going to be adjusted up above 10%, and it's been a headwind as well this year because the adjustments don't happen until the end of the quarter. So at 7.5%, that adjustment was made January 1st of this year. So until that time, as rates were higher, their cost of capital is a little bit higher, and then it readjusts to kind of balance itself out. And so they've also been an adjustment by the SBA, where now you can charge 3% above prime. So that should also benefit them as well. The remaining 25% that's not guaranteed by the government, Newtek is pari passu with the SBA in event of a default. And that, again, helps de-risk the company in case there are defaults on their loans that they give. And they've also increased the credit worthiness of the new loans they've put out. And you can see there's a 725 FICO scores, their weighted average on the new loans that they've put out. And so what the company does is they hold back the 25%, and then it's backed by a bond issue that they do, where they're able to, again, use some leverage to make a spread, again, off the loan. But they're able to, the key thing here is they're able to service the full loan amount. And so that has a nice recurring revenue. So they're able to get paid upfront in addition to servicing the loan and getting nice recurring revenues as well, which we like in pretty much any business that we invest in. And so that provides Newtek with very nice cash flows. And a quick upfront payment, like I mentioned. 504 loans and non-conforming loans. So 504 loans are typically larger loans. It's backed by real estate as well, typically, and they're larger size loans. The one thing to understand about SBA loans in general is that if you're able to get funding in a traditional manner or in a non-SBA manner, you're not allowed to take SBA loans. And so what happens a lot with NewTek is a potential borrower will come to them and say, hey, we want to borrow through this SBA loan program. And they have to do certain tests to say, hey, are you able to borrow or raise capital in a different manner? And if they are able to raise capital in a different manner, then you can't take an SBA loan. So NewTek has traditionally done some non-conforming loans where if they don't fall in this bucket of these SBA loans, they find another way to lend them money. But what happened last year, which was quite exciting for the company, was they were able to get a basket of these non-conforming loans that they've done with these companies that aren't able to do SBA loans because, they're able to get loans elsewhere. And they were able to securitize those and put them in a basket together to help fund those as well too long term. So that's another area of growth and a new area of growth for the company. I mentioned this a little bit in the last slide. This is a slide showing what the premiums they get for immediately selling off the guaranteed portions of these SBA loans are. And you can see the last few years it's you know, prior to 2022, you know, it's always been above 10.5%. And the last few quarters, it's gone below that. So we expect it on average to be around 10.5% in our own models. And so again, like the profitability last year is kind of understating what we think will be a more normalized margin.
One thing I wanted to say over here was, just so folks kind of follow the idea. So when they originate a loan, obviously they have a balance sheet, especially as a bank. So they could just keep the loan for the duration of the loan. But what they generally do is they sell off the guaranteed portion, which is essentially, because it's SBA backed, it's essentially backed by the government. And so there's a huge demand for that because there's very little credit risk on that portion. So what that allows them to do is if they have the volume, which they do as a, you know, as let's say the second largest SBA lender in the country, they can recycle the capital again and again. I don't recall what the time cycle is, but let's just say you originate an SBA loan, you fund it yourself on your balance sheet, and then, you know, X amount of days later, you know, call it a month later or whatever, you can sell it off to somebody. And so in the course of a year on the same base of funding, you can essentially make these margins every single time on the SBA portion of the loan. And that velocity of deploying your capital, getting it back at a 10% premium, deploying it again multiple times a year is much more profitable than holding on to a loan, you know, for 5 years or whatever, 10 years, and just collecting the spread. So essentially it kind of pulls forward some of the spread and then gives them their capital back to go and do it all over again.
Yeah, it's even more liquid. It's like a week to 2 weeks, they're able to sell off individual loans, the guaranteed portion. So, yeah. And then this is kind of showing, again, the portion that they do hold on to, the interest income versus their expenses. You can see versus 2019, interest expenses have gone up. Sorry, versus 2019, it's gone up a little bit, but versus 2020, 2021, when interest rates were at historic lows, their spreads on interest income versus interest expense were quite high. But again, as a bank holding company, their interest expense, we expect to drop and should drop as well too. So they're going to be able to get some nice net interest margin on the loans that they have. And then the other aspect that kind of gets overshadowed, especially as a BDC, which is likely to change as a bank holding company in a non-BDC, is the service businesses that NewTek has. As a BDC, pretty much the main thing that shows up on their financials is NAV, net asset value of the companies. And so going forward, they're going to be able to break out things like revenue of every business on their financials, all the expenses and all the different line items that they weren't able to do as a BDC. So BDC is kind of a black box. And so now we're going to be able to see a lot more transparency in the business financials. And so just to understand the different businesses, they have a payment processing companies. They have two, and NewTek Merchant Solutions and Mobile Money. In 2022, this is as of the end of the third quarter, the company expected to have $16 million of EBITDA for the combined two processing companies. And at that subsidiary level, they had $12 million of debt. So you can value that, whatever you think. Payment processing companies typically go at 9 to 10 times EBITDA. Then they have technology solutions that provides cloud computing. They have a facility in Phoenix, I believe, that has the infrastructure for this. And that business in 2022 did $4 million EBITDA, and there's about $11 million in net debt there. And then they also have like a POS system, which is similar to Square and Clover. But one of the things that they differentiate themselves on is that they're able to add some of their scheduling and other payroll and other things into that POS as well too. So they try to provide more value-added services to their clients. They also have payroll and benefit solutions and insurance solutions that aren't very material to their bottom line as of now. But with the bank, pretty much, I'll go into it on the next slide. So this is kind of the vision that the company has in terms of being a combination of a bank and a fintech company in a way, where they're able to provide with technology these added services and kind of be the main, like just like you check your bank account as a company, I'm sure most companies check them, if not daily, at least like weekly or monthly. You're able to go in here and see more than just your bank account. You're able to see, your actual loans. It's kind of small, but you can see like there's a merchant account button on the left side as well too. You can see your payroll. You could store documents. And the key that NewTek plans on doing to differentiate themselves even more from a traditional bank is to have a bunch of specialists that you can click on and talk to. And you'll be able to talk to them via video if you want, phone call, text message, whatever it is. But that's kind of the vision going forward with the bank, and to kind of have this platform being central where it allows you to, oh, I didn't know NewTek. I have a loan from NewTek, an SBA loan. Oh, I didn't know they do payroll solutions. Let me get on the phone with someone who can help me do that and maybe compare it to my current provider or an insurance specialist to see, hey, like, am I missing gaps with my insurance or not? And also even things like your website traffic, these are things that they can help show up on your dashboard. In addition to storing documents, a lot of times companies have documents all over the place or in an unsecure cloud. And so again, with their IT services company or subsidiary, they're able to provide this benefit to clients as well if they're needed. This is just another screenshot the company has posted about what their dashboard is going to look like. And they announced, they had a call this in the morning actually to give some more details about the merger and the completion of it and what things will look like. So if you're interested, I suggest taking a look at that presentation. It goes into much more detail about what the different bank metrics and the company metrics will look like. What they think it'll look like going forward, but this is another view of the dashboard where you can see, what things potentially can look like, and they hope to launch this on February 1st.
I wanted to just say a couple of things on this section here. So, one is it's sort of interesting because it shows the sort of entrepreneurial outside the box nature of the company's management. And the fact that they do have a tremendous amount of these relationships with these businesses. So it's definitely something that a lot of businesses need. And if this works, it would definitely create probably a good amount of value for their clients over and above the lending and give them a lot of cross-selling, cross-marketing opportunities. You know, from my experience, like a lot of financial companies talk about doing, you know, cross-selling and stuff, and either mostly it doesn't work out because it's sort of hard to change the DNA of a company, or in the worst case, like if you saw what happened with Wells Fargo, where they sort of shoved it down people's throats, it actually leads to big problems. And even in the case of Wells Fargo, you know, a lot of basically fraudulent activity by the employees who are being pressured to cross-sell on these arbitrary metrics. But what we think is interesting is like they have, so this is almost like a fintech type of play embedded within essentially a bank slash lender. So to us, we see this as maybe optionality or upside to the projections that we have if it were to work very well. You know, the jury's out on how well it's going to work out, how well they'll be able to execute. It's definitely challenging, I want to point out, to do this. But even if they're able to pull off sort of a baby version and they get adoption by some percentage of their customers, something like a dashboard, you know, could be very valuable that a lot of these small businesses don't have. What I think is interesting about this is, you know, clearly they could do this because they have all these relationships, and they realize that. And so they're thinking this, but what's interesting about their approach is that they're, you know, so all of these different things, the, you know, the dashboard, the payroll services, business checking accounts and things, which is now with, as a bank, they can really offer, and then merchant services, and even IT services, all these things that they're trying to integrate into one. What's interesting to me about this is that instead of just sort of partnering with external companies where it would be very hard to integrate all of these and offer a seamless solution, they've sort of grown a lot of these in-house, which I think is sort of pretty interesting. That's really unusual that they have all of these capabilities in-house, and they've sort of either bought them with small little tuck-in acquisitions or they've built them in-house. So I think there's the advantage of that is that one is there if they can pull it off, and they already have, you know, real businesses in these areas, though those sort of small businesses, business units, when you look at the scale of these businesses relative to their penetration, they're a very, very small player. But where it could be interesting is if they pull this off and they're able to offer this sort of integrated dashboard and all of these different services and sort of are able to get clients to use them on these multiple services, it could be really interesting to see what they can do with this. Because the fact that they've homegrown it means that their margins would be higher ultimately. And they have more ability to integrate everything in one, which is quite hard to do. I'd say that the biggest drawback of the approach is that they're not really a scale player in any of these ancillary things. So while they're say number two in SBA lending, in payroll services or in business checking or merchant accounts or whatever, they'd be a very, very tiny player. So it'll be interesting to follow, at least for us, how their idea pans out in terms of how they're able to execute on it. But we think it's interesting that the management team is ambitious enough to attempt this, and they seem to already be rolling out some things that are going to get adoption, and they might also be white labeled to other banks. So there's sort of this optionality of several of these different things that really aren't really baked into the current upside that we're seeing on just the base business turning into a bank. But if this works out, and I wouldn't say it's any certainty that it would, it could be interesting upside to our base case.
Yeah. And like right now, they're actually not able to do a business checking account. They're just able to do it like as of a week ago, but they haven't launched that yet. And the other thing that is kind of interesting as well is in terms of the bank acquisition, which we didn't touch on earlier, they acquired the bank for $20 million. I know some other people who were looking to acquire banks around that same time, and they were shocked to hear that they were able to acquire a bank for just $20 million, which was at book. they said they couldn't find anything less than $60 or $70 million. And so it just kind of shows you that, you know, the executive team here really is, you know, quite concerned with where they're putting their dollars at work. Which leads me to the next slide. The CEO and also founder of the company, he owns, this is as of the last proxy, which I think he owns a little bit more now of the company, but approximately 4.8% of the company. And so the shares are currently valued at around $21 million. So he's very well aligned with us shareholders, and he gets a base salary of $700,000. So again, he's going to make most of his money based off of, you know, growing the value of this business. Again, not as much from getting a salary as CEO. So that's very important for us. You know, at Ridgewood in general, it's very important for us and also as shareholders. And so this slide here gets me very excited. This is the profitability targets that they've announced as a bank. And you know, you look at this and you're like, okay, it's a 3% return on average asset, 3 to 4% in the first year. With improvements in the second year, same as return on average tangible common equity, 18 to 22%, and then increasing and then 2024. And they have, you can see here, they have high bank cost of deposits. But again, they're trying to attract deposits here. And so they're going to be paying, you know, very competitive rates in terms of savings accounts and checking accounts as well, and also CDs. And so the big key here to understand is that they are currently paying around 6% interest on the loans that they have or the bond issues that they have out. And so this decreases their cost of capital. And then again, going back to the BDC versus bank holding company, now they're able to retain their earnings and reinvest that. Whereas a BDC, they weren't able to do that. They had to pay out 90 to 100% of profits. And so again, there's going to be extra expenses in the first year. So, you know, earnings, if you look at, again, now they're paying taxes, which in as a BDC, they weren't. So post-tax earnings will be $1.70 to $2 is what they're expecting this year. And that should jump up in the next year to $2.80 and $3.20. Which again allows them to some of that is from reinvesting their retained earnings, and also the other aspect is, you know, they're going to grow as a bank, and so they can offset some of their overhead as well too. And then just going again, I just want to pop back to this slide. Is they put out a presentation early this morning. It was hard for me to update, but it goes into a lot of details and line by line items to as a bank, how they're able to get to these targets that we see on this slide. And then just to understand, like, you see numbers of ROAAs of, you know, 3%. And I just wanted to compare to Axos Bank, which is a top tier bank as well, that they're in the top, you know, 10% of banks. And so if you look at Newtek, like, they're going to exceed a lot of these numbers, and by a nice margin. So like that puts Newtek in the efficiency of Newtek is going to be quite amazing. And a lot of it is because they don't have bank branches. They don't have bankers. Their leads come through this referral network, and they get about 1,000 leads a day. And so that is really, it's hard to show that on a slide, but that's really where a lot of the value of Newtek comes from, is that they're able to acquire customers at a very, very cheap rate versus other banks.
There's another piece to it too, which is like, if you look at banks, right, it's relatively simple in the sense that they have, and different banks are different in terms of where they make their money. So some banks are more like, they're good at loaning things out and getting high rates on what they lend out. Other banks are good in funding, so they have low cost of funding, but they don't really get too much on what they loan out at. And obviously fee income is a third source for banks. And then it's how much do you spend to give the services that you make? Well, in the case of Newtek, right, they're in this lending business, the SBA world, as a non-bank financial. And so the rates on those type of loans are already quite a bit higher than the typical bank that lends mortgages or whatever. So, and that was sort of the insight behind, I think, this bank merger is that, hey, we're lending at these higher rates. Now, obviously, they're getting higher rates for maybe potentially somewhat of a more complicated or higher risk type of thing, but they've done it for a long time and they know it well. And so, hey, we're generating, let's say, whatever amount, much more than the typical bank, call it 8%, whatever, I'm just for argument's sake. And our cost of funding is 6%. So if we can keep making the type of loans that we've already made, but our cost of funding goes down to 3 to 4%, 4.5%, then that margin goes up quite a bit compared to their existing business. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why their ROAA and ROE could be much higher. And then a second piece of it is that, hey, we've got all of these businesses and we don't really get their deposits. So we can also maybe using this dashboard and a more of a cross sell and integrated, we'll do everything for you kind of model. We'll get low cost deposits once we become a bank by providing these businesses checking accounts. And also by getting wholesale deposits, even if we offer a premium compared to our lending rates, the margin's still a lot higher and our cost of funding is still a lot lower than what we used to have to pay when we weren't a bank. So it's because of those reasons. And then for the reason that Sam just said, where, hey, we don't have a ton of branches, we don't have a ton of bankers, we don't have all this stuff. A lot of it is basically relationships that are referral relationships from probably different brokers. And so we get or the online channel direct. And so we get these leads and we have agents, telephone agents who will talk to people and get them applications processed, get them onboarded as a customer. And initially they might come in for an SBA loan, but then It's a small business. Typically, if you're getting an SBA loan, it's because somebody's buying the business or they're looking to grow the business. So if we can serve them and maybe also give them a bank account, handle their payroll, handle their IT services, and give them a unified dashboard, that's all incremental margin. So that's the idea of it. Obviously, they've been executing on it as a non-bank institution, and now being a bank, it gives them some extra quivers in the arrow, including a lower cost of funding, but obviously also comes with some extra regulation and things, which naturally they've thought about and they think it's worthwhile.
And the other thing here is that most, they're not competing with other banks that are doing real estate loans, automobile loans, things of that sort. The market size of SBA loans is just generally not as big. So the big money center banks, they don't really want to, it's not worth their time and effort to spend on this. But then to understand the risk as well of these loans, it on the surface, it seems risky. Oh, I'm lending to a business, but every single one of their loans gets personal guarantees of every owner above 20%. It's guarantees against all of the personal assets and all of the business assets as well too. So in terms of the risk, it's de-risked to some degree versus what's generally thought of. And then also on the other end, the benefit to the borrower is that most business loans don't have 10 to 25 year amortization schedules. So the actual payments, even though the interest rates are high or potentially high, again, they're floating, the benefit is that they don't have to pay down the loan as quickly as traditional business loans. So that's really where the benefit is to the borrower in these loans and why it is attractive and why people, businesses look for these type of loans. So again, like as a bank, one of the main, we've touched on this a bunch of times, I don't really want to do too much, but like they were issuing a lot of stock as a BDC to grow. And so now they don't need to do that to grow anymore. They can retain earnings and they could use more leverage, as you can see on the next bullet point. They can lever the company now more than they were able to as a BDC. Banks can lever up to 10 times. BDCs were, I think, 2 times is how much leverage you can use. And then also the cost of capital, much lower as a bank. We've talked about this quite a bit. The business referrals is a way the company thinks they'll be able to attract deposits. For example, on the merchant account side of things for the credit, where they accept credit cards. Typically, if you get a credit card payment, it takes a few days for it to actually hit your bank account. Newtek can potentially offer and say, hey, because we're doing the merchant processing, and if you put in our bank account, we'll give you same day clearance. Same with payroll. Payroll typically takes a few days. You have to pre-fund an account, and then you send it to your employees' accounts. And there's usually like a 3-4 day time period that it takes. Again, if Newtek can tell their customers or their clients, hey, if you put payroll on our, if you use our bank account for your payroll, you know, we can fund that same day. So you don't need to have that floating. And also they can provide other promotions as well too, to get deposits as well to the bank. And then again, going back to the slide where they talk about what their ROAs and ROATCs they expect to be, banks with greater than 2% ROAs and 15% return on tangible equity are in the top performing 10% of banks, which is, you know, quite amazing. And Newtek's targeting 3-4% and between 18-20% in 2023. And so banks historically that get those numbers traditionally trade at much higher multiples than the average bank. And again, this is also a growth bank as well too. So, you know, again, what multiple, we'll go into evaluation a little bit, but the multiple that I believe we're using is quite conservative. And then so on the low end of range of $1.70 in earnings that the company targets with 24 million shares outstanding and assuming 3% dividend yield, which was between the 2-4%. Actually, in the call today, the company talked about a 4% dividend yield. So this number that they retain of $40 million, which they weren't able to retain as a BDC, we think, you know, again, they could lever that 10-1. So it just shows you the ability they're able to fund their growth by retaining their capital internally. Ken harped on it quite a bit, so just going to reiterate, the opportunity here exists because of this transition from BDC to bank holding company. And again, the company's put out a lot of presentations, but again, until you start seeing the numbers, until the company starts releasing their financials and their first Q as a bank, where they're able to show all the transparency, I think it's going to be a little tough for people to trust what the company is going to do. One of the advantages that I find to being in the small and microcap space is that, I think I've met Barry probably like 7 or 8 years ago, and I've been following the company for a while. And even though I don't, we never invested in it until more recently. It's something where we follow and we see how he's performing. We get a sense of, hey, is what he says, does it end up, you know, happening or not? And so from our experience, you know, we've been quite impressed with how he's been able to perform. And we find this is a great opportunity and a great price point to get in the next kind of stage of the company. And there's been a huge transition of shareholders that of people who were all they were in for the company for was the yield as a BDC. And the yield, it'll be somewhat attractive, but not as attractive. And that's not why, you know, you're really buying the company now. You're buying it really for the growth and, you know, the earnings per share that's going to be able to grow without diluting capital, which we like. There is risk here, obviously, but we think with the hires that the company's made, and the experience the company has in, it's effectively doing the same business, but as a bank holding company versus a non-bank lender. So we feel like it's not as risky as what, maybe on the surface it seems. And so we actually quite like that a lot in a lot of the investments we make. We like to find stuff that on the surface generally seems, like it has a lot of hair on it, but then when you do a deep dive and you get to understand what's actually happening, it's not as risky as what it shows on the surface. And look, like there's a reason why a lot of companies don't do this. It took over a year from when they announced the acquisition of the Bank of New York that to get it approved. And they got it, I think the finalization happened January 7th. And so during this time period, a lot of BDC investors left. There was probably a lot of tax loss selling as well too, towards the end of the year. And also bank valuations have come down a lot as well due to the interest rate hikes and economic concerns as well too. Accounting for, like I mentioned, accounting for BDCs and banks are very, very different. All subsidiaries of the BDC, you can't put full kind of financial accounting in the filings. You pretty much act as if you're a shareholder of those companies, and you have to talk about what the NAV is and the dividend distributions from those subsidiaries are, even if you own 100% of it. So now they're going to be able to consolidate everything together and show line items like revenues on those businesses and their costs as well too. So it'll be much, much better versus, you know, historically he's kind of given numbers on a presentation on the quarterly call that he gives as to like what those businesses have been doing. And then no financials have been filed as a bank. So again, like you're kind of taking a leap of trust and faith in management as to what the bank will look like. Again, you can kind of back it out off of what the BDC was doing, and like the $2.70 of dividends in 2022 kind of gives you numbers in 2024 estimates, because again, that $2.70 number should be around 90 to 100% of what the net income was as a BDC. So if you take out taxes, which they will start paying, and then you retain earnings and you grow their loan book, just based off of that, that's kind of how you get to the 2024 estimates of $3 a share. Here's a comparable of a bunch of banks as well. And I'd say the things to kind of take here is that look at the 2024 estimates. If you scroll down, you see the average is, you know, just a little average and median are both a little bit under 11 times their 2024 earnings of this group of banks. And then the one company that I would say is the best comp here is the ticker's LOB, Live Oak Bank Shares. They have about half their loan book is SBA loans. And so if you look at their forward multiple, they have a 13.95 times this year, 2023, and then a 2024 is 12 times for their earnings. And you could see there, their earnings have dropped, will drop, well, we're expected to drop from 430 a share in 2022 to 230 a share in 2023. So banks have been pressured quite a bit, similar to what Newtek has been pressured. But again, Newtek has a lot of adjustable rate loans, and there is a lag between their cost of funding and what their revenues will be. So again, just using the midpoint of where we expect 2024 numbers to be, we expect the company to get to $3 of earnings per share due to lower interest expenses and growing SBA loans. Not much of selling more business services, but we do have, you know, some increase because the company has been increasing that historically. You know, the four I mentioned in the last slide, forward bank multiples around 11 times. This is kind of depressed as well too. So banks, especially higher growth banks, trade at historically around 15 to 20 times with the ROEs and ROAs that Newtek is, you know, plans to post. You know, that 15 times is quite conservative there. And I mentioned Live Oak is a very good comp, trades at 12 times 2024 earnings. Triumph Financial is probably the next best comp, and that's at 14 times 2024 earnings. So we think that conservatively giving Newtek a 12 times its 2024 number is kind of a fair number to give. And with that, you get the $3 earnings per share, 12 times multiple gives you a $36 price target in 2024. And so that's kind of how we back into that. And the one other thing that is kind of potentially another catalyst is that BDCs are excluded from the Russell 2000 and S&P 500 and 600 and other indexes and ETFs. And also it's, there's a certain thing, I don't know the 100% all the details, but there's a lot of institutions can't actually invest in BDCs due to some of the ways that I guess they're filed and get certain tax treatment as well too. So this being a bank holding company will allow the Russell and institutions to be able to buy shares in NewTek. Again, that's if it's included in the Russell 2000, which based off the size, we expect it that it should be included in the Russell 2000 when the new entries are able to go in. So just to talk about some of the risks here, you know, one of the risks is that the demand for their loans drop and the SBA loans drop and many of the borrowers default. And so two things on that aspect, you know, the SBA government guarantees helps that a lot. And also every single one of the loans has a personal guarantees by the borrowers. And there's typically all the assets of the business are backed. And typically there's real estate assets, inventory, receivables, other things of that sort that act as collateral for the loans as well too. So it's usually they're pretty conservative in the loans that the company gives out. And you can see, like, if you go look at the details of the SBA, the 504 loans, which are typically larger than the 7A, they started doing that in 2017 and they've never had a default on any of the loans they have there. So, you know, that kind of gives you a sense of the type of underwriting that they do for their loans. Our model assumes that the company can get some loan growth in the first year and defaults don't increase dramatically. The one thing that we do kind of expect is that these non-conforming loans, again, they're non-conforming in the sense that they don't conform to the SBA standards, but that they're able to grow that portion that they weren't, they historically haven't lent to. And that's something that we kind of expect they should be able to increase. And then also the other thing that they put in the presentation that we don't have as well is they're going to start doing, again, when the loans don't qualify for traditional SBA loans, they're going to start doing like commercial loans to lend against certain like equipment, like someone wants to buy a piece of equipment. And they're going to do more traditional loans, that bank loans on that side of the business as well. So that aspect we kind of expect should grow as well too, but it won't be a big part of their business. The other risk is that the dashboard doesn't create, you know, any cross-selling synergies, or they're not able to attract deposits. Again, I think, you know, if you're able to, if the company is able to go and say, hey, we're going to give you 4% on a savings account, we think that is likely to attract some deposits. And so we don't think that's that much of a risk, but you never know. This is, again, a new business. Maybe people don't want, you know, a high interest rate on that, or they'll go to another bank that is competing with NewTek in terms of attracting deposits. And another risk we find with companies, but I don't think it's much here, is, you know, a poor acquisition. And so, you know, in hindsight, we may look and say, hey, this $20 million bank acquisition that the company made, you know, was not a great acquisition. But again, I've talked about some of the reasons why we think it's not as risky for them, as they've been pretty much performing the same business model as a non-bank lender. And I don't think he's going to go in and make another big acquisition. There's a lot on his plate in terms of now running this business as a bank versus a non-bank. So, and then the other aspect is, you never know, like the government may stop guaranteeing portions of the SBA loans, or, you know, change the SBA program for some reason. We don't think that's likely, but again, that is a risk, a potential risk. And the other risk is if a lot of their loans go bad, the SBA may, you know, take away their license of being able to issue or originate these new loans. And that is the end of our presentation. I want to thank you all for, you know, taking the time to listen to us, and hope it was helpful.
Great. Thank you so much, Ken and Sam. And thanks for showing your contact information here on the screen. We are out of time for this session, but I would encourage MOI Global members to follow up with their own thoughts or questions. We are also happy to facilitate an introduction as desired. Once again, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this year and articulate this investment thesis in such great depth.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye for now.